even though the diction was ornate and the narrative method at times oblique. What I had always loved was a kind of four-squareness about the utterance, a feeling of living inside a constantly indicative mood, in the presence of an understanding that assumes you share an awareness of the perilous nature of life, and are yet capable of seeing it steadily and, when necessary, sternly. There is an undiluted quality about the Beowulf poet's sense of the world, which gives his lines immense emotional credibility and allows him to make general observations about life which are far too grounded in experience and reticence to be called moralizing. These so-called gnomic parts of the poem have the cadence and force of earned wisdom, and their combination of cogency and verity was again something that I could remember from the speech I heard as a youngster in the scullion kitchen. When I translate lines 24 to 25 as, "Behaviour that's admired is the path to power among people everywhere," I am attending as much to the grain of my original vernacular as to the content of the Anglo-Saxon lines. But then, the evidence suggests that this middle ground between oral tradition and the demands of written practice was also the ground occupied by the Beowulf poet. The style of the poem is hospitable to the kind of formulaic phrases which are the stock in trade of oral bards, and yet it is marked too by the self-consciousness of an artist convinced that we must labour to be beautiful. In one area, my own labours have been less than thoroughgoing. I have not followed the strict metrical rules that bound the Anglo-Saxon shope. I have been guided by the fundamental pattern of four stresses to the line, but I allow myself several transgressions. For example, I don't always employ alliteration, and sometimes I alliterate only in one half of the line. When these breaches occur, it is because I prefer to let the natural sound of sense prevail over the demands of the convention. I have been reluctant to force an artificial shape or an unusual word choice just for the sake of correctness. In general, the alliteration varies from the shadowy to the substantial, from the properly to the improperly distributed. Substantial and proper are such lines as, "The fortunes of war favoured Hrothgar. The highest in the land would lend advice and find friendship in the father's embrace." Here, the caesura is definite. There are two stresses in each half of the line, and the first stressed syllable of the second half alliterates with the first or the second or both of the stressed syllables in the first half. The main deviation from this is one which other translators have allowed themselves, the freedom, that is, to alliterate on the fourth stressed syllable, a practice which breaks the rule, but which nevertheless does bind the line together. "We have heard of those princes' heroic campaigns, and he crossed over into the Lord's keeping." In the course of the translation, such deviations, distortions, syncopations, and extensions do occur. What I was after first and foremost was a narrative line that sounded as if it meant business, and I was prepared to sacrifice other things in pursuit of this directness of utterance. The apositional nature of the Old English syntax, for example, is somewhat slighted here, as is the Beowulf poet's resourcefulness with synonyms and, to a lesser extent, his genius for compound making, kennings, and all sorts of variation. Usually, as at line 1209, where I rendered "Uthiful" as "frothing wavat," and line 1523, where "Badalema" becomes "battle torch," I try to match the poet's analogy-seeking habit at its most original, and I use all the common coinages for the lord of the nation, variously referred to as "ring-giver," treasure giver, his people's shield, or shepherd, or helmet. I have been less faithful, however, to the way the poet rings the changes when it comes to compounds, meaning a sword or a spear or a battle or any bloody encounter with foes. Old English abounds in vigorous and evocative and specifically poetic words for these things, but I have tended to follow modern usage and in the main have called a sword a sword. There was one area, however, where a certain strangeness in the diction came naturally. In those instances where a local Ulster word seemed either poetically or historically right, I felt free to use it. For example, at lines 324 and 2988, I used the word graith for harness, and at 3026, hoked for rooted about, because the local term seemed in each case to have special body and force. Then, for reasons of historical suggestiveness, I have in several instances used the word bawn to refer to Hrothgar's hall. In Elizabethan English, bawn, from the Irish bó dún, is a fort for cattle, referred specifically to the fortified dwellings which the English planters built in Ireland to keep the dispossessed natives at bay. So it seemed the proper term to apply to the embattled keep where Hrothgar waits and watches. Indeed, every time I read the lovely interlude that tells of the minstrel singing in Heorot just before the first attacks of Grendel, I cannot help thinking of Edmund Spenser in Kilcolman Castle, reading the early cantos of the Faerie Queen to Sir Walter Raleigh, just before the Irish burned the castle and drove Spenser out of Munster back to the Elizabethan court. Putting a bawn into Beowulf seems one way for an Irish poet to come to terms with that complex history of conquest and colony, absorption and resistance, integrity and antagonism, a history which has to be clearly acknowledged by all concerned in order to render it ever more willable forward again and again and again. This ends the essay by Seamus Heaney on translating Beowulf. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Inferno of Dante by Dante Alighieri, translated by Robert Pinsky and also narrated by George Goodell. Here is preserved the burning clarity and universal relevance of this 13th century literary masterpiece in a triumphant new translation for our time. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalogue, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So, to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalogue, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune into narrative profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.